good morning. And I know we're going to leave questions till the end, but I do want to acknowledge that sometimes people have a challenge just understanding what I'm saying. So sometimes if I say water or ice, and you're like, what? Just feel free, raise your hand. You won't be the first one. Dunkin' Donuts and I continuously have a dialogue when I order iced coffee. So I will not, I don't take it personally. Siri understands me on my cell phone, but Dunkin' Donuts doesn't. So do I use it? Awesome. Thank you. And what I'm going to talk about today is primarily a project that I was involved in. It was a HRSA study that just ended, and we're now at the point of kind of pooling all our knowledge together, looking at lessons learned, what worked, what didn't work. And it's really cool as an evaluator to say, yes, some things worked really well, and including the process. Sometimes you go into projects and you hope for the best and kind of wait and see. The Channels Project looked at refugees and immigrants in Maine, and it's a small population, but a population that's often not looked at and not addressed. When you first arrive in the States, often refugees and immigrants are worried about culture, language, finding work, trying to order a cup of coffee, those types of things, and health is not a priority. We also tend to be people who are the most uninsured. In Maine currently, if you look at the refugee and immigrant or refugee and asylum seeker population, they and compare them with the Maine population, they're three times as likely to be uninsured. So the Channels Project looked to address this need in three different perspectives. First, looking at service. They're putting a clinic in a housing establishment, doing some public health activities. I know a lot of people don't like health fairs. They really worked and helped to demystify things. There were vision initiatives, providing people with glasses that were pretty cool, and you can adapt them. So, you know, often if you come from a refugee camp, you might have these issues that just, you know, they weren't a priority there, and now they could be addressed, and also for oral health. So that was very much the service side of things. There was also looking at a very strong point of interprofessional collaboration and introducing community health workers into a clinical care team, which was a wonderful experience and was something very new for everybody. They also looked at a nurse leader institute. So a lot of nurses are trained to be nurses and find themselves in public health and looking to take a leadership role, and hadn't ever had training in leadership. And then finally there was looking at students and bringing dental and physical therapy and all these different students together. So really from the beginning to try and get the interprofessional collaboration principles. So I just got to geek out and say I'm an evaluator. I only think in terms of logic models. And, you know, we didn't have a problem with outputs and really short-term outcomes. Everything was done very collaboratively. We have partners. It wasn't complicated. We were in from the beginning. But it was really kind of, I want to say halfway through, when we were starting to think, how do we really look at long-term outcomes? And it was at that stage HRSA was also starting, you know, the triple aims just came out. HRSA was saying, well, can you look at triple aims? And we're like, sure, we can look at them, but we really struggle to look at them and measure them. And the triple aims, they refer to as many different things, but there really are three aims that healthcare systems try and achieve and are restructured to increase experience of care with patients, decrease the costs, and also being used more as population health. And so a lot of times it's getting, you know, typically your hospitals and your health departments together to speak a common language. And it's definitely something new in the field that on an implementation as well as an evaluation level, we're trying to figure out together. And what we did when we figured out we didn't have the solutions, one of the things I've come to love about Maine is when there's a problem, everyone gets together and everyone's from different funding sources and it doesn't matter. And we called ourselves the Unified Data Group. I don't know why we called it Unified Data Group, but it sounded like a cool name at the time. And it very much was everybody around. So it was whoever wanted to come and join us in talking about, you know, data. And so there weren't full data geeks. There were a lot of community health workers that are embedded in all the different agencies. We had the state minority health agency. We had hospitals. We had the university. There's Maine Access Immigrant Network, some grassroots organizations, and of course, the us. And what we did was we said, let's come up with a few data items or data elements. And that was probably the most challenging part. You know, everyone's got their own funding, so if you have got HRSA, you need to report these funding data. If you have CDC, you need a different. And so it kind of was, everyone had to step out of their funding requirements and looking at where do we find the common ground. And I can tell you it was challenging, but it wasn't as painful as I expected. If you get a bunch of us evaluators together, we came up with a lot bigger list than what this group did. So it was really cool to watch and to see what could work, what can't work, whether you are doing outreach for health insurance or you're doing screening for cancer. What are these core data elements that would be interesting to you? And those are what we came up with. We then went and we looked at which tools should we use, which can be implemented through, again, all these various different systems. And we came up with three. One was the patient activation measure. Some of my colleagues in the room, and they'll know, people said, I need to change my name from Michelle to Pam, mm-hmm. because that's all I keep talking about. It's a really cool measure. There are costs, and so, you know, there's some challenges with it, but what it does is it looks at activation. And I really would encourage people, you're welcome to chat to me about it. I think this is part of the way we can see changes in interventions around minority populations, and it shows basically at level one, you are not engaged in the health system, you don't have the knowledge and skills to really engage in a discussion with your provider, to make changes to your health management. Where at level four, you're engaged, you've got a sense of mastery, and there is literature that shows these costs. So if you can move a patient from level one, it's really been shown a lot with chronic disease, if you can move a patient from level one to level four, you can save X amount per patient. So it starts to be looking at, I want not really return on investment, but in some kind of cost analysis. And when we did the PAM, it's a 13 question, so it's really simple, and we just added a whole lot of core data items. We also looked at standard ways of community health workers logging their activities. So we've got like four different projects, different community health workers. What are the core things that they could be capturing every time they meet somebody? Because the idea is we can pull the data and we can go, we can go from a really small sample size to at least a slightly bigger sample size. And then the CAPS looks at patient satisfaction. It's the standard, everyone uses it. I'm not such a big fan of it, but it is what it is. And then what we did was we looked at what's the best way to implement this. And this is very much where our community health workers, the people kind of on the ground, helped. We wanted to do a baseline on patient activation. So at a health fair we did raffles, we got people to fill in the PAMs. We got everybody, whether they were using Salesforce, do forms on paper, to log every time they saw a patient. And then we did CAPS surveys. We did them paper-based and on a little iPad. and we had the community health workers administer it. So the caps, if you've been to a doctor or hospital lately, you typically get this in the post, and it's like this 20-page survey that they ask you to respond to. I think the average return rate is about 7%. Obviously, when you're doing interviews and that, we had 100% response rate. So yes, just briefly, so what happened is everyone did the data collection. We were the central hub that helped do the analysis and then gave it out to people. What we were able to say for our funding was that our community health workers were engaged with the right people, they were doing the right things, and that the patients had good experiences. We didn't say they had better experiences than others. We did no comparative studies with our partners, but it helped us to see and to report on a lot more than I thought we would be able to. Just some of the benefits of collaboration from our side, from channels, as well as from our partners, there's a larger data set. If you've got a sample size of 10, or you have a sample size of 950, it makes a difference. And a lot of the organizations will use this a lot for proposals as well, because again, when you're trying to show a need and you've got data, it really helps. There was less resources for all the community partners. One of the challenges is if you're a small grassroots organization, for example, Main Access Immigrant Network, they could never have the resources to do this amount of evaluation and get the sample sizes. And then it kind of perpetuates itself because you don't have the data, so you can't put in the proposal, so you don't get the resources, so you don't get the data. And that's really what I thought this was a great way of equaling the playing fields and giving all organizations equal access to the data and the analysis. There was a lot less community burden. We didn't have the same person being asked to fill in 10 different forms. We believe it's sustainable. It wasn't high resource intensive. And it was applicable across all the settings and all the platforms. So one of the initial challenges we had was, well, you know, our community health workers use Salesforce to capture activities, and other organizations do forms, and some use paper. And by having these core elements, it didn't really matter, because ultimately you can export everything into Excel. And so that really helped from the outset. The minority health took these, and for data elements, and for their new grantees, they've said these are the reporting requirements. So in a way, that's what's become sustainable about it. Out of all the years, and I'm particularly today feeling older than normal, I've never come across this amount of flexibility and what's made it work. And so a lot of what we've looked at is like, why has it worked? We've tried many times with collective impact. Everyone's always trying to aim for shared values, shared measures, and often it doesn't work. I think this worked because we had a flexible contract that the principal investigator for channels didn't say we are only going to use the evaluation for the evaluation contract, and for channels there was a lot more. She was fine to engage in this community process. And the people at the table trusted each other. So there wasn't this like, you're going to take my data and you're going to use it, you're going to take my data and compare your program to my program. We didn't have any data agreements. We had no agreements. It was like at a meeting, there were notes from meetings, that was about as formal as people just trusted us. And that's part of, I think, the channel's principal investigator, Jen Morton, is just an amazing woman who has credibility in the field. She's at University of New England, so there was a lot of credibility that she brought to the table. It was an existing network, so for the most part, a lot of people weren't coming to the table for the first time. And there was one evaluator, and this is done in complete respect to all my fellow colleagues. I think if there were a few of us around the table, we might have had more heated discussions about which data elements. That I think having just the implementers, they were okay to let the nuances go, where we would have got stuck on detail. There was no cost to the partners to participate, other than the effort with, you know, getting the data collection and that. And there was a small set of data items. It was centralized around a specific population in a small geographic area. I don't think this would work statewide. I don't think this would work in a big place. I don't think this would work virtually. It really, because it's so embedded in relationships, we needed to sit at the table together, looking at each other and working together through this. I'm very happy at any time if people want to chat about it. Please feel free to contact me. I think it is unique, but I think it's completely doable. So thank you very much.
This question is, you had a question?
Yes, I just thank you all for your presentation. I was just wanting to ask the first presenters about their involvement, the community involvement in terms of the health survey. So I don't know if I missed this. When the community participants did the survey, if you could speak to like the sorts of questions that were asked and if there was some sort of health professional assisting them. So, because I thought about like if blood pressure type data was collected, you know, were there people within that were trained to make sure that it was, you know, accurate collections or stuff like that. So could you speak towards the type of health data that you collected in conjunction with the community?
Yeah, it was mostly focused around self-reporting. Have you been diagnosed with hypertension? Do you have diabetes? Do your children have diabetes? Do you have social support? You know, how often do you contact your friends? Or how often do you see your relatives? So it was mostly self-reporting, and eventually it to kind of build off, eventually spin off into where there's more direct services, but it was really to kind of assess where the community thinks, where they're at, and you know, the presentation wasn't really about the results and where the community thinks they're at and where they're actually at. There is really a big gap.
It was a pretty easy survey. I thought it was harder to get. No, I don't need it. I speak very loudly.
Okay.
It was harder to get the community to come out and be involved due to the fact that being Native American and being in an urban area, we have been overly researched. Let's put it like that. Everything from diabetes to alcoholism, and it's like, really? And we're doing this again, and we're participating. Basically, that was some of the stuff we got, was we're participating in it this time. We're part of it, you know? And we're like, yeah, we are, because we're gonna own the data, because so many people come into our community and do research, and we don't get the results, so we have no idea what our community needs. And this time, we actually own it. And yeah, there's a little issue with the red cap and the youth, but we still own it. And in order for us to achieve goals that we need to fix and change, we need to own the stuff. So that was the big difference. I'm trying to get my community to come out and be like, we need to come out, we need to do this. You know, because we've been overly researched for crazy things, I believe.
Other questions? Dr. Sam, I had a question for you about your programming in North Carolina. Are there aims to incorporate some of that data into clinical practice?
Yeah. Yes, thank you for that question. So, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the presentation, we have community, academic, and medical partners in this work. And so, as far as the both the ACURE and the CHAMP study, we have buy-in and involvement from key leaders within the healthcare systems that we're working with, who are very interested in our findings, especially as it relates to systemic barriers to care and systemic factors contributing to racial inequity and cancer treatment completion, and also the quality of the treatment with respect to symptoms and symptom management. So the expectation is that from these findings, the findings that we generate, we'll disseminate it and share it with the leaders within the healthcare system, in addition to our community and academic partners, in order to help inform interventions, help inform changes in practices in order to improve care equity.
Any other questions?
Okay, actually, I have one for the first group. I'm wondering if, considering the context of how historically researchers have gone in, if you did any outreach as a for the whole group to get them to maybe meet the researchers, to explain overall what the general idea was with the research and how it differed from what's been done in the past, or if you did that individually when you went to recruit people.
We did a combination. We did round tables first to find out what we wanted our questions to be, so our community knew it was coming. And then when we went door to door to set up appointments, we talked to them about what was going to be on there. And when they came in the door, I talked to them. But they knew it was coming because we started out with round tables. And then we went door to door and explained to them exactly what it is. And out of 212 households, I had two households refuse to do the survey. Mm-hmm. But by the middle of the second week, both of them households came in. One of them refused because they had other members in their household and they were scared, and another one refused because of their working hours, and they actually brought their children with them when they did the survey.
Wonderful work, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on the Cochrane review. Mm-hmm. So, two questions really. Number one is, why do you think that you're picking up so little of a signal for community participation? And number two kind of feeds into the first one. I'm still not sure what your comparison group is, because I don't know of any study that compares directly a non-community intervention to a community intervention to see if one is better than another.
Can you go back to your first question, please?
Why do you think you're not picking up a signal that that community coalitions work?
Well, we did actually write a little bit in our discussion that there's a lot of discussion in the literature about the inadequacy of analytic measures for looking at multi-level interventions, and that perhaps that we don't have the right measures to capture the signal. I'm not sure that that's true, but it seems plausible. I thought you were asking why we were finding so few collaborations that were community-based versus academic partnerships or public health partnerships, and I think that has to do with resources and funding. And I'm sorry, I've already forgotten your second question.
Now, if I were going to be funny, I'd say I forgot it too. No, the second question is, I don't see,
the comparison.
I don't see where anybody directly compares, you know, a top-down intervention to a bottom-up intervention. I'm not sure what you're really comparing.
We were looking at, the studies we looked at had a comparison between a community-driven intervention in one community and a community that didn't get an intervention. Only one study looked at comparing those two situations with also a situation of an intervention that wasn't community coalition-driven. Does that make sense? Only one study did that. And that was our point about
how do we find out if it's a value add for it being coalition driven or not? There are plenty of community collaborative interventions that aren't driven by a coalition of community members. Yeah, I guess there aren't enough comparative studies out there, but that's the comparison we had was intervention or no intervention. Yes, that makes sense.
So you're saying that even when there's a community intervention, you couldn't get any signal at all to measure an outcome difference?
No, we could measure outcome difference. There were outcome differences. We just looked at standardized mean difference effect size. For health status reported or health outcomes reported. And the effects we saw for 3 or 4 engagement strategies were modest. And we don't know, is that just because this really isn't a coalition-driven intervention, really doesn't make the difference we think it should? Is it because of what's being reported or not reported, or is it because the measures that we use aren't appropriate for what we're trying to capture? I don't have the answer to that question. Do you have some thoughts about it?
Well, I was going to say, what should we do then?
Certainly, we would have liked to have seen studies reporting the kinds of details that were shared today about the nature of the collaborative process. They developed guiding principles. We could be looking at, well, as we said, we couldn't compare what kind of coalition structure might be more effective than another in the cases where we did see a beneficial effect, because studies didn't report those details. So I guess that's the bottom line plea, that if researchers are committed to this concept of a coalition-driven intervention, then please don't just tell us the health outcome measures. Please tell us about your process so we can evaluate what kind of structure and process is more effective than another, and let's fill all of you. And I don't know, perhaps it needs, I guess we should be grateful, those of us who are invested in this a worthwhile approach, that funding continues for coalitions, and I think that certainly government funding is still interested in asking for research that involves the community. I don't know if that can be sustained if we can't show evidence that it actually makes a difference.
I would think, you're thinking, but I'm going to comment anyway, just the way I am. I would think that community-based research, prevention, all of that has to come from partnering within the community, because for a community where people have tried to save us so many times, that come into, we got 20 churches that come into our community. You know, we've got these people coming in to help. We're all going to save the poor Indians, and none of it helped. We still have a problem with alcoholism. We still have a problem with drugs in them. If it's not community-based, trying to build it up, you're not going to succeed with an intervention or prevention. You have to start within the heart of the community. And for us, we're urban areas, urban Indians, so it's even double harder for us, because we're experiencing the trauma of relocation. Where the ones who stayed on the reservations, they're still experiencing historical trauma, but we also got trauma that's happened within the last 50 years. I'm the first one in my family to be an urban-born Indian. My dad, all my brothers, everybody was born on the reservation. I'm also the first one to speak English only. I'm learning my own language, Lucky I come from a traditional family, so I know a lot of my spirituality in that, but I just think it has to come from within the communities. It has to. Otherwise, it's not going to work. You can't come in and tell me what you think I need. We have to be partners and work together. I know I wasn't part of your question, but I got to give my two cents.
No, I totally agree with you. But the thing is, I think one of the weaknesses in the design of the Cochrane thing is that there are a lot of research intervention projects that derive from the community that aren't necessarily their third generation projects that aren't directly from the coalition. And so you're measuring an outcome down here of an intervention that's spurred from the community here, and you're not making the actual connection in your review. And work in medical communities and in people communities for a while, you know, stakeholders make it happen, and how you form a coalition, I think, means everything.
Can I just add, I don't think I need the microphone, I really appreciate you raising that issue about the long-term interval. I think particularly with community coalitions who are working on establishing trust. Someone did a theory of a maturity of coalitions and came up with a 7-year phase to get to the point that you had something really functional and well-established. What study capture that, and your point about something that happens 10 years later that's a derivation of an original coalition. Very important thing to be considering.
So 7 years does not hurt.
One last question in the back.
And right now, there's no direct funding coming to the university at all for this project, so it's a matter of a researcher stepping in and saying, okay, now let's apply for funding. And then the researcher and then us basically publish it so that it gets to a place a part where the evidence is built. And I think that's the issue, too.
Thank you all for coming to this session.